call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. A quorum is present. Today, members will be hearing from representatives of the Minnesota Private Detectives Board, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, the Department of Corrections, and the Department of Public Safety. We will later be inviting the Ombudsperson for Corrections, the Executive Director of the Post Board, and representatives of county probation to present to the committee at a later date when we schedule relevant bills. But before we get to those presentations, we need an approval of last meeting's minutes. Representative Novotny, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 5th, 2023?
I so move, Chair.
Representative Novotny moves approval of the minutes for January 5th, 2023. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for January 5th, 2023 are approved. All right, so our first presentation today, before we get to that, members, we will hold all questions until the end of all the last presentations. And so if something comes up and you want to ask a question, please make sure to let our staff know so that we can keep track of that. And again, we'll get through the presentations first and have those questions at the end. For members of the public, we have copies of presentations and written testimonies in the committee photos for members on the front table here and on the committee webpage. And our first presenter will be Chris Kaiza with the Minnesota Private Detectives Board. It's my understanding that you are filling in for Kate White, the executive director, who's unable to join us today. And welcome to the committee, Ms. Kaiza, and please state your name and title for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
So my name is Christine Kaiza, and I'm with the Private Detective Board, and I am fairly new to the board, so go easy on the questions.
Welcome. Go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. So you should have in your packets what we have up on our screen here, but I'd just like to start by thanking you for letting us come before the board. Executive Director Kate White was unable to make it today due to illness, so along with Abby Smith, that she and I will try to answer any questions that you have after our presentation. First of all, the mission of the Private Detective Board is to ensure investigative and security service practitioners meet statutory qualifications and training for licensure and maintain standards set forth by the Minnesota statutes and administrative rules. That board was created in 1974, and we have five members on that board. The stakeholders, just to name a few, are citizens, the private detective and protective agent license holders themselves, law enforcement, government agencies, local businesses, and training providers alike. If you look at page 7 and 8 of this document that we ordered, we'll put it up here too. We'll be kind of moving around through the document, by the way. You can see that we have a list of functions that we do. There's a list of functions that we do within our agency. We are responsible for the license holders themselves as they make application to get a license. We're responsible for their renewals when they go to renew every 2 years. We are approving training, and we are in charge of any investigations and complaints that do come into the board. So we have monthly meetings that are held the last Tuesday of every month, which is also stated in the packet. In regards to the training, just to give you an overview of the amount of training we get, requests we get, we have 195 that are, training providers that have been approved and are reviewed by the members of this agency. And with those 195, we have 1,400 approved courses that we have reviewed and made sure are to standards for training for both private investigators and investigator protective agents as well. Just to put that in perspective, this agency has 3 full-time employees, which includes our executive director, and then myself, who's in a part-time role. So with those, the 4 of us, we're not only doing the training, but approving applications for licensing and also the renewals, which involves checking everybody's credentials to make sure they've had the proper training to keep their license. Another thing to keep in perspective is that this state has currently over 13,000 security entities, meaning they are employees of private investigators and or private or protective agent boards. As of December 22nd, we have a total of 384 total license holders based off of our database. However, if you go into the Department of Economic and Economic Development, it shows that there are 510, which tells you that out of the 202 private detective license and the 182 protective agent license, that doesn't add up, and there's a lot of unlicensed activity going on out there. One other note is that in 2021, we had 166 private protective agents and 190 private investigators. So we saw a slight increase in 2022 for requests to have licensing in those two divisions. Again, pointing out that there's just three full-time positions and one part-timer that are overseeing all of this at one time. We'd like to end by just saying, in the current state of public safety with the numbers declining and police officers, et cetera, we are concerned with the unlicensed activity, as I'm sure everybody else is. Many of the agents that are on the streets, whether they be in a private grocery store in a neighborhood or whatever, could be unlicensed, untrained, or undertrained. That's a deep concern because, again, going back to 13,000 agents on that we know of, and being some of them on are unlicensed, it's a dangerous, slippery slope that we're on. We are concerned for the stakeholders and businesses relying on that private security that they used to get from law enforcement. With the numbers, again, having worked in some private security myself, I know that wait times for law enforcement are long. So we currently do not have the staffing to meet the statute language and or continuing to approve all these licensing and confirming their training levels.
Great. Thank you so much for your testimony. And if you can just hang out for a little bit before we get to the other presentations in case members have questions.
Thank you all.
Yes, thank you. Next on the list is Nate Wright, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Welcome to the committee, Director Wright. And as a reminder, please state your name and title for the record, and you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nate Wright. I lead the staff of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and it's a pleasure to be able to introduce my commission to you today. Thank you for having me, Madam Chair. Let me start by talking about the structure of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and sort of what the legislature was thinking in 1978 when it created the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. So let's look back at 1978. What was the world of sentencing like back then? It was really indeterminate. So there was a lot of discretion on two ends. One, there was discretion with the judges. The judges basically had the discretion to sentence zero to the statutory maximum. And they'd sentence within that range sometimes. So the sentence might be 0 to 10 years, for example, might be the sentence. And then the second avenue of discretion came in on the backside with the parole board. So the parole board had a great deal of discretion within that 0 to 10 years to grant early release. And the focus really was on rehabilitation. We'll release this person when this person's ready to be released, essentially. So there were concerns. So this indeterminate sentencing structure fell out of favor in the 70s with concerns about disparities, concerns about people not being treated similarly. And so the Minnesota legislature in 1978 created the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. It was the first sentencing guidelines commission in the nation. And the commission had the mandate to create advisory guidelines to the district court, and judges were required to provide written reasons for departing from the guidelines. So it was a determinate sentencing model. So what the victim or the public or anybody sitting in the sentencing hearing would know what the sentence was. The pronounced sentence was what the defendant was going to get. with one-third time off for good behavior, essentially, is a way to think of it, or if the defendant misbehaved while in prison, the defendant might have to serve the entire sentence. But typically, two-thirds of the pronounced sentence was what was going to be served. So really a truth in sentencing goal. So the 1978 legislature gave the commission what I'm going to describe as six mandates, and those six mandates are still in place today. The first three had to do with the sentencing guidelines. So obviously the Sentencing Guidelines Commission has to establish sentencing guidelines for the district court, and then it's not done once it did that. So that in 1980 when it turned in the report, it wasn't finished. It continues to meet on a monthly basis to modify and improve the sentencing guidelines, and then it reports to the legislature on such modifications annually. But the legislature had a broader vision for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. It really had this vision of the sentencing guidelines being a clearinghouse and information center for sentencing data across the state. And we see to this day that typically states that have sentencing guidelines commissions, because a number of other states followed Minnesota's model in having sentencing guidelines, we see that those states have some of the best data on sentencing practices in that state. So the commission was to serve as a clearinghouse and information center with respect to state and local sentencing practices data, and to conduct ongoing research on various matters related to the improvement of the criminal justice system, and then to kind of close that feedback loop to come and make recommendations to the commission, in addition to improving the sentencing guidelines, also to come back to you and make recommendations to the legislature on changes in criminal law and procedure and other aspects of sentencing. In fact, they do have a few recommendations that the legislature has, or that the commission has for the legislature this year. Let's talk first about establishing those sentencing guidelines for the district court. So the sentencing guidelines really kind of divided up the authority, the distribution of the sentencing authority in three different ways. The legislature still has that responsibility to establish broad policy standards and statutory maximum. So the statutory maximum still serves as the upper limit for punishment, and it reviews the sentencing guidelines. So on Friday, when we submit the report to the legislature, if there are changes to the sentencing guidelines in there, and I have to speak hypothetically because the commission meets on Thursday to decide whether there will be changes to the sentencing guidelines that will be submitted to you on Friday. So stay tuned for that. But you then have a chance to review them. So the commission's statutorily obligated to submit its changes to you, then you have an opportunity to review that. And then the commission establishes these advisory sentencing guidelines to the district court, so that's its distribution of sentencing authority. And then the judges are where the rubber meets the road. They take the individual case, the individual defendant in front of that judge, as well as the circumstances of the crime, the input from victims, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and probation officers, and put that all together with a sentence. So let's talk about who's on the commission. So the commission was designed, I guess I can't say it was, because the membership composition, the legislature's changed that over the years, but here's what it looks like now. The first tier is the judiciary. So all three levels of the Minnesota judiciary are represented on the commission. There's a Supreme Court justice, a Court of Appeals judge, and a district court judge on the commission. In addition, the parties to the lawsuit of a criminal case, basically, are also represented. We have public defenders and prosecutors are represented. And when I speak in the plural, I don't mean to mislead. There's only one person from each of these. So it's kind of a small, streamlined commission with the idea of being efficient. So there's one public defender, one county attorney on the commission. In addition to that, we have the people who are in the process before and after the criminal case. So we have police represented on the commission, and then the Commissioner of Corrections is on the commission, as well as probation officers are represented on the commission, with the probation officer represented. And finally, we have three members of the public who are on the commission. The current chair is Kelly Lynn Mitchell. She's one of the public members. She happens to be my predecessor, and she's the executive director of the Robina Institute, which is really a national sentencing policy think tank. That's headquartered at the University of Minnesota. One of those public members is required to be a crime victim. So let's talk a little bit about the sentencing guidelines themselves. And I intended for you to have copies of the sentencing grids in your packet. It doesn't look like those made it. I will contact Ms. McDaniel and see if we can't get those to you afterwards, but because otherwise you're not going to be able to see them on here. So there's a sentencing grid for you, but let me just kind of tell you how it works. Obviously, you can't read that. So basically, like any grid, it's a two-dimensional grid, right? So there's a horizontal axis and a vertical axis. In this case, the vertical axis is the offense severity. So the least severe offenses are at the bottom. The most severe offenses are at the top. This is the standard grid. So we have fleeing a peace officer is an example of an offense severity level one. There are many severity level one offenses. And murder in the second degree, intentional murder, is at severity level 11. And then you have the horizontal axis, which is the criminal history score. So vertical axis looking at the offense, horizontal axis looking at the defendant, the offender who committed the crime. And that's looking at the person's criminal history. It's a complicated score. There's four components, but the primary one is prior felony offenses. So that can move you across the grid from left to right. So first time offenders are in the first column. Their criminal history score is zero. So each cell in this grid contains a presumptive prison duration in months. And then and judges must impose this duration or explain the reasons why. But there are shaded cells here. So shaded cells have a presumptive stayed sentence up to a year in jail. The zero to year in jail is still very discretionary with the judge. The sentencing guidelines don't really get involved until we're talking about a prison recommendation. But if it is a prison recommendation, that's in the white cells typically, although there are some exceptions for mandatory minimums where the legislature's created a sort of a statutory presumptive prison sentence. And there's also a broad range within there, a 20% down, 15% up range within which the judge may sentence without departing from the sentencing guidelines. Apologize, I know this is a very quick overview of what the sentencing guidelines are. Be happy to come and explain this in more detail or answer questions if you like. But sort of the principle here is that these are supposed to govern the typical offense. So that's what the commission ranks these offenses based on. You know, this is how severe we think a typical offense is, keeping in mind that some offenses are drawn pretty broadly, and that's why judges have the opportunity to depart. So if a particular offense that's committed, you know, as committed, is less serious or more serious than a typical offense, or this defendant is deserving of leniency for particular reasons, then the judge may depart from the sentencing guidelines. But as I said before, the judge has to articulate substantial and compelling reasons for a departure from those sentencing guidelines. What's the point of all this? There are many goals of the sentencing guidelines: to assure public safety, to promote uniformity in sentencing so that we've got the people with similar crimes and similar criminal histories, again, horizontal, vertical axis, are treated similarly. Same thing with proportionality. So we're trying to come up with a sentence that's proportional to the offense and the criminal history. And some offenses are considered so serious that even first-time offenders are recommended prison. In addition, the sentencing guidelines are intended to be neutral with respect to race, gender, social, or economic status of convicted felons. And the commission recognizes that the legislature requires the commission to recognize that correctional resources are finite. And so we have limited capacity. And so those resources should be reserved for those convicted of the more serious offenses or those with longer criminal histories. And departures should be made only in substantial and compelling reasons. So I'd like to spend the last few minutes of my time talking about the commission's resources for the legislature. So we have this report to the legislature, which I'd be happy to come back and present to you, but it hasn't been published yet. We'll find out all together on Friday what's going to be in it. I can tell you, though, we don't have any 22 changes to report. We may have some 23 changes to report to you, but essentially neither the commission nor the legislature passed a lot of stuff last year. So for the first time that I can remember, there are no changes to the sentencing guidelines last year. We do have some recommendations to the legislature, which I'll cover. We have a report on a mandated review. You told us to review how the sentencing guidelines cover sex trafficking, and the commission did that, and it has a report on that. and it has a summary of 2021 felony sentencing practices in Minnesota. It does take us a long time, at least with our current staffing and resources, to get that data back. So what we're reporting on, unfortunately, is 2021 data, but you'll find a lot of interesting data in there. And County Attorney's Firearms Report. That's not our data. That's data that you tell each of the 87 counties to report to us and tell us to report to you. And that has to do with departures from mandatory minimums under Minnesota Statute 60911. There's a list of crimes. If you're commit those crimes with a firearm, there's a presumptive prison sentence required, and we report that to you on how that comes out. So here are the recommendations to the legislature. I know you probably can't read that, but I'll just tell you what they are. And all three of these came out of our sex trafficking review. They aren't all necessarily related to sex trafficking, but they're just things that we found that should be fixed. The commission unanimously recommends that the legislature fix them. The first has to do with a definition that's found in labor trafficking, but it's the same words are used in sex trafficking, and those terms are debt bondage and forced labor or services. There's no crosstalk between those two, so really the labor trafficking definition should cross-reference the sex trafficking statute so that it's clear that those are the same terms. The second recommendation is when the 2021 legislature updated all criminal sex-related age thresholds from, it used to be 13 years, so the cutoff was if it was under age 13, if the victim was under age 13 or above age 13, it was more or less serious. The legislature missed one. At least that's the only rational interpretation I can think of in the child prostitution statute. So the commission recommends that the legislature change that it's mentioned six times in the prostitution statute. If the legislature would just change that last one to 14 instead of 13, because right now the same behavior is criminalized in different ways, so it doesn't make sense. And the final recommendation is there's a statutory violent crime list in 609-1095. That has on there the offense of first-degree witness tampering. Well, there's a more serious offense called aggravated first-degree witness tampering, and that's not on the list, which just doesn't make sense. So we think you should either add that to the list or swap it out for swap out first-degree for aggravated first-degree. But it doesn't make sense to have a more violent offense that's not on the violent crime list. And I should just say, by the way, there's a 2020 recommendation to define the minimum term of imprisonment for life sentence for first-degree murder of an unborn child. Right now that is not defined. So if somebody is ever convicted of first degree murder of an unborn child, the Commissioner of Corrections has no idea when to release that person. It's never happened yet. So far it's always been convicted concurrently with the first degree murder of the mother. And so that's life without the possibility of release. But it could happen. It's very foreseeable and it's not defined.
Mr. Reitz, I'm going to stop you right there.
Yes.
Just to make sure we have time for members to have questions after all the presenters are coming. I know you have a couple more slides.
I know.
We have some questions for you already. So
okay.
My hope is that you could finish up your slides when you come back for questions.
Oh, certainly.
All right, great. Thank you so much. Members, our next presentation is going to be from Commissioner Schnell for the Department of Corrections and Probation. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Schnell, and please state your name for the record and go ahead with the presentation.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be here today and to see you all in person. It's great. My name is Paul Schnell, and I have the honor of serving as the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Corrections. And I want to thank you for having me here today and the opportunity to provide an overview of the work being done at the Department of Corrections. I'm honored to have the chance to work with you and look forward to meeting with you individually in the coming days and weeks. Know that you can always reach out to me or my staff, Emily Lefholtz, who's gonna drive the PowerPoint here for me today, who's our legislative director, or Safia Khan, who's our chief of staff at any time. The DOC's mission is to transform lives for a safer Minnesota. The work of the DOC not only makes our state a safer place to live, work, and raise a family, successful rehabilitation results in reduced crime, fewer victims, less fear, and reduced cost. We often hear about the need to break the cycle in the criminal legal system, and the Department of Corrections and our corrections partners endeavor to do just that. Madam Chair and committee members, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go over this slide except to say that the department's strategic plan guides our work, and I wanted you to have copies of the agency's strategic plan in your packets, and would love to talk with you in more detail when we have the opportunity to meet one-on-one. Over the past 4 years, even with all the focus required to manage COVID, we reorganized the department to be more person-centered, data-focused, evidence-based, and transformative. While we've made progress, we have a long way to go. The DOC is the third largest state agency and is extremely complex, but our work essentially boils down to this. We work with individuals and develop plans to rehabilitate those in the system based on their needs and risk factors. Two, we provide programming and services to those individuals while they are incarcerated. Or three, we provide intervention and support services to those on probation or on supervised release so that they integrate or transition to the community and live pro-social lives. Moving on to the DOC as it relates to a high-level overview. The DOC has a large and dedicated workforce, but like other public safety sectors, we are experiencing significant challenges in recruiting and retaining them. Our biannual budget is $1.2 billion, and our work with you on this committee is so critical because the Department of Corrections is 96% funded by the state's general fund. The DOC has an enormous footprint across the state, 11 prisons, 7.5 million square feet of facility space, making our bonding requests just to address deferred maintenance critical. I'll speak more to the numbers on capacity and community supervision shortly. Also, for your reference, this slide is a quick overview of the 11 facilities that the DOC operates. I encourage you to tour the facilities, speak directly with staff and the individuals incarcerated in them. A couple of references of note, the facility in Shakopee, Representative Tabke's district, is Minnesota's only women's prison. Red Wing is the state's juvenile correctional facility focusing on treatment. The St. Cloud facility serves as the central intake facility for men. Faribault is the state's largest facility with a population capacity of just over 2,000, and the Togo site up near Canada there is the smallest facility, one of the two men's boot camps. The prisons in Stillwater and St. Cloud are both well over 100 years old. As you can see in this slide, Minnesota's prison population is staggeringly disproportionate and an issue that we must and are devoting attention to. I also want to draw your attention to the numbers on the right side of the slide. Each of these data points reflects a unique and important challenge to our work as well as yours. And I hope that you will keep them in mind front and center as you continue to make decisions in this committee and in others where there is an intersection throughout the session. Madam Chair, members, if there is one thing I'd like you to take away from my time with you today is this. Over 95% of the people in Minnesota prisons will return to neighborhoods and communities across our state. Because of this, we must ensure that those in our care, custody, and control have access to services and supports that they need. The safety of our state depends upon it. Over the past few years, we have been restructuring and reorganizing the department focused on a person-centered approach. Simply put, the person-centered approach organizes and matches evidence-based programs and services targeted at the needs and risk factors of the people in the system. Research tells us this is what works. More on this another day. I also have a couple of slides to illustrate both the historical and projected prison population. In this first slide, you can see that the population declined dramatically during the COVID-19 pandemic. Court backlogs during shutdowns and efforts at the local level to keep individuals out of high-risk congregate living settings drove prison commitments down dramatically. Also, just a few years ago, you'll notice that the state's incarcerated population was above the prison capacity, resulting in a number of conversations about whether or not to build a prison. The decline from 2015 to 2019 was due in large part to drug sentencing reform passed in 2016. On the next slide, here again you will see the effect of COVID on the prison population. The COVID population downturn resulted in the agency taking a $21 million budget reduction. You can see the projected exponential population growth as the court works through the COVID backlog. We project being at or above capacity by 2025. This number reflects single bunking at Stillwater, as recommended by the OLA in their 2020 report on prison safety. Note that Rush City remains double bunked, despite the fact that it was built as a single bunking facility. Now briefly, I'll provide an overview of the agency. As I mentioned, we have the third largest state agency in Minnesota, and our work is divided across various divisions. First, I've had the honor of serving as commissioner for the past 4 years. I'm immensely proud of the work our supervision partners and staff in the DOC across the state have done. They've been front and center delivering services around the clock, even throughout the pandemic. Prior to serving in this role, I had the honor of working in policing, a deputy sheriff in Carver County, a dozen years with the St. Paul Police Department, and as police chief in the cities of Hastings, Maplewood, and Invergrove Heights. Just out of college, I worked in community-based corrections programs for about 6 years before transitioning to law enforcement. Our largest division is the Facilities Safety and Security Division, which consists of over 2,000 uniformed security staff, the Office of Special Investigations, which includes a licensed law enforcement contingent focused on fugitive apprehension. The safety unit and other core functions such as capital resources are also in this division. Correctional facilities are essentially unique, secure communities and require a large dedicated staff to keep them running safely. The division is overseen by Deputy Commissioner Michelle Smith. The Reintegration and Restorative Services Division includes our Reentry Services Unit, the Hearings and Release Unit, Juvenile Justice Reform, Risk Assessment and Community Notification, Grants and Subsidies, and a large community supervision unit. Deputy Commissioner Curtis Shanklin oversees this division. We will talk about this more later, but I want to be sure to point out that the DOC provides community supervision and probation services in many smaller counties across the state. But it's important to note that there are three delivery systems of supervision in the state, and the DOC is proud to work with our county community supervision partners, both county corrections, Community Corrections Act counties, and county probation officers who provide the majority of supervision services across the state. But we will be talking about this more in this, as the session moves forward. Moving on to our Health and Recovery and Programs Division, this division houses all of DOC's health services, which are constitutionally mandated, including treatment services, medical care, and other programming work of the department. Programming in prisons can include anything from cognitive behavioral therapy to spiritual services, and all depend on robust case management services. The work of this division is overseen by Assistant Commissioner Nan Larson. Our Organizational and Regulatory Services Division contains the operational infrastructure and regulatory units of the department, including Human Resources, the Office of Professional Accountability, Peer Support, IT, Victim Assistance and Restorative Justice, and the jail inspections and enforcement team that licenses and inspects correctional facilities across the state. Assistant Commissioner Connie Jones oversees this division. With the Commissioner's Office, we have several key agency-wide services, including policy and rulemaking, legislative affairs, tribal relations, equity, access and inclusion, project management, and research and planning and performance. These are all overseen by our Chief of Staff, Assistant Commissioner Safia Khan. Finally, there are three members of the Commissioner's Office who you should also be aware of. Emily Leffholz, who I had introduced earlier, is a great contact. If you have any questions about the DOC or there are constituent concerns, or you'd like to request a tour. Quasi Paisley is our CFO, and he will be the point of contact in our budget discussions going forward. Our former longtime CFO, Chris Dodge, retired just this past month. And finally, Karen Robinson is our general counsel and leads that unit. The work of corrections is hard, and our staff deserve all the credit for the contributions they make to the lives of those who are incarcerated, as well as the impact they have on public safety in our state. Members, we are grateful for you, our elected leaders, who are invested in helping them succeed in their work and the outcomes of the DOC overall. Finally, correctional services, I would say, have a direct impact on public safety, including crime reductions, reducing the number of victims, and creating safer communities. A 1 percentage point reduction in the state's 3-year re-imprisonment rate would yield this: an estimated $5.4 million in costs avoided to the Department of Corrections, and an estimated $57.7 million in additional costs avoided to the state, victims, businesses, and society in general. We hope to talk with you more about this in future meetings. Finally, I would just say this. It's hard to understand the work without seeing what happens in these correctional facilities firsthand. There's nothing like it, and I would welcome and encourage you to come out and visit and see the work in person. And with that, Madam Chair, I will step aside for the next presenter.
Thank you, Commissioner, and I'm glad to see that final slide, because without asking you, I offered that at our first hearing, that members maybe during the interim could get a tour of some of your correctional facilities. So
we strongly encourage
you.
Thank
Wonderful.
You.
Great. All right, so our next presentation is going to be from the Department of Public Safety. We have a new commissioner for the department, Commissioner Jacobson. So congratulations on your new role, Commissioner. Welcome to our committee, and please go ahead and introduce yourself and begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, members of the committee. I am accompanied here today by our legislative director, Jordan Halterheide. Did I get that close?
Close enough.
All right. That's my first time saying that publicly, so Jordan, I'll get it closer the next time. But again, my honor to be here today and my honor to be the new Commissioner of Public Safety. As you may know, I was sworn in on January 2nd, Monday, and so I am 1 week and 1 day into the position as the Commissioner of Public Safety. So I'm learning on the fly and doing the best that I can. We have some great staff who are here as well today, so if I'm unable to answer some of your questions, I know that we'll have some others here available that will be able to answer them for you. Again, just briefly about my career. As I've told people, and I've said this a number of times, I'm an epic failure at retirement. I retired for the first time from the New Brighton Department of Public Safety, 32 plus years in law enforcement with that community. I enjoyed it greatly, and I know that Chair Mueller represents a part of the city of New Brighton. We have lots of folks here. So. But again, I loved working in the city of New Brighton, again, law enforcement focused, but retired as the director of public safety, so I oversaw police, fire, and emergency management. So I'm new to the Department of Public Safety, but I have a great deal of experience, been around for a long time through a number of public safety functions over those years. After I retired from there, I'll just briefly, I had several jobs. I've retired after each one, and I keep coming back, but I was a professional development coordinator for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, focused on training for leadership around the state of Minnesota. Also developed a peer support and some wellness programs for our police chiefs, coordinated a lot of our conferences and regional meetings, so I had an opportunity for 2.5 years to really get around our state and meet our chiefs of police around the state of Minnesota. I retired again. I ended up my first stint with the Department of Human Services came in during a leadership transition. I was the interim inspector general for about 5 months. I retired again, came back for the city of Stillwater, filled in during an interim transition for police chief. Retired once again, and my kids have told me, don't say retirement because you really don't ever retire, and that's probably accurate. But I came back to the Department of Human Services where I was upon taking this appointment, working in Children and Family Services. Again, my honor to have been appointed. This position, when it came up, went to my heart of service. Certainly it would have been easier to be, in many ways, to be retired, to hang out with my 9 grandchildren, 8 of whom are 5 years of age and under. And my favorite name is Papa Bob. And but this calling, this position, really was something that attracted me to that life of service. Again, my thanks to Governor Waltz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan for giving me this opportunity. Our first slide, just again briefly, an overview of the Department of Public Safety. You can see that we have 11 different unique divisions with over 2,100 employees, 2 legislative committees that we report to. But today we're going to focus on alcohol and gambling, Fire Marshal Division, Justice Programs, Emergency Communication Networks, Homeland Security, and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Just a little bit of the history. This was new to me as well, but the Department of Public Safety was created in 1969, so I'm older than the Department of Public Safety. I'm not sure if I get anything for that, but the latest addition to the Department of Public Safety was the Office of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Office that was created in 2021. And again, very happy to be working with that group. First, the next division we'll talk about is Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, led by Director Carlos Sincotta. It has a mix of sworn and non-sworn staff that are part of Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. And they're really responsible for the regulation and enforcement of gambling and alcohol laws across the state of Minnesota. When it comes to alcohol enforcement, a big part of what they do in their work is they're responsible for the issuance of alcohol licenses, permits. They do a lot of inspections, compliance, and they do criminal investigations as well related to gambling and alcohol. To the gambling piece, again, alcohol and gambling oversees and covers gambling games, pull tabs, bingo. They monitor 18 tribal casinos in the state of Minnesota. In 2022, they completed 170 gambling investigations, so they've been very busy. We also this year added our first canine to alcohol and gambling enforcement. We have the only currency detection canine in the state of Minnesota. Bia is the name of our canine. And we also added this year a highlight for us, body cameras for all of our agents in alcohol and gambling enforcement. We thought that was an important thing to do.
Commissioner, I'm just going to stop you for a second and say A-plus for including a dog in your slides. That's
Madam Chair, they did not bring the dog, so I'll call that an A-plus is warranted.
All right, we'll say an A-minus, and we can talk about maybe having a chance to meet the dog at some point. Go ahead, Commissioner.
All right, lesson learned. Staff, please write down, bring the dog. We will do so. Thank you. Again, next on to the Fire Marshal's Division. It's led by our State Fire Marshal, Jim Smith. And the Fire Marshal's Office, of course, provides statewide leadership, guidance when it comes to fire and life safety policy enforcement, very good when it comes to prevention and education. A list of their work, some of the things that they've been able to do over the last year is our State Fire Marshal's Office. Our investigators have helped local fire departments. They've done 921 investigations in 2022, a high number. They've worked with Minnesota fire officials more than 600 times for issues ranging from fire department consolidation to fire reporting processes. They have a fire boot camp, which I wasn't aware until I got here, which is training for new and upcoming leaders in the fire service, and they trained 82 officers last year. Some of the achievements. For the State Fire Marshal's Office, we launched a predictive model and risk mapping tool to assist in targeting high-risk areas for fire prevention and risk reduction, and they completed thousands of different inspections, and you can see that list of locations and business types where they do those different inspections throughout the year. Our Office of Justice Programs. The Office of Justice Programs works to reduce crime, improve the criminal justice system, and very importantly, assist crime victims. And that program is led by Executive Director Kate Weeks, who is also here today. Those services that they assist in providing, crime victim services, lots of grants, including justice and community grants, training. They do research, and they do communications. And they are critical. They managed 619 grants in 2022, totaling over $100 million in grants that went out. Some of the examples of those grants were for domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, and other shelter programs. And they also help fund sex trafficking investigative task forces, violent crime enforcement teams, and many others, as you can see on that list. Some of the achievements for our Office of Justice Programs, again, they have been assisting with our missing and murdered indigenous relatives work in the cases that we have developed. They worked with more than 1,000 crime victims, criminal justice professionals, and members of the public last year, and they helped receive nearly 2,000 reparation claims and coordinated payment of over $3.2 million. To crime victims, which I think is critically important. Next up is the Emergency Communication Networks. That division of emergency communication encompasses five different programs and critical public safety communication networks. It is led by our director, Dana Wahlberg. That includes our 9/11 program, the design, the maintenance, and support and management for 9/11 centers. We have 103 across the state. We don't operate those, but we help support those. And our 9/11 systems around the state handle about 2.9 million calls per year. So it's a very busy system. Some of our other services within emergency communication networks are our Armor radio program, which if you've heard about interoperability, so first responders can communicate. And we also have the public alert and warning systems. In 2022, we alerted the state to dangers 272 times. That included 50 alerts sent by public safety agencies, 141 weather alerts, of course, and 91 of those alerts were just testing to make sure that the systems are working correctly. Some of those achievements for the Emergency Communication Network. We're continuing to improve technology, move to next-generation 911, the text to 911, smart devices, as you may know, calling 911, and even more. And really importantly, I thought there was the rollout this year, partnering with the Minnesota Department of Health on the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, that 988 number. I'm going to move on to Homeland Security and Emergency Management. That is led by our interim director, Kevin Reed. Homeland Security Emergency Management really helps communities prepare for, respond, recover from emergencies and disasters. We have a few examples of some of their work over the last year. The School Safety Center has been moving along quite well. Their focus is on prevention and planning and policy, for safety in our schools. Our Emergency Operations Center is activated, of course, during times of disaster or emergencies, and it's the hub for state agencies and their partners to support local governments. Homeland Security also does a significant amount of training for emergency management professionals around the state of Minnesota. Some of those achievements for Homeland Security, we responded to three presidential disaster declarations totaling about $50 million in damage. And we responded to 12 state disaster declarations, also for about $12.3 million in damages. And again, we did a lot of training with 106 instructor-led training courses for over 1,000 hours this year. Last division I'm going to talk about today is about our Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, a very active and high-profile division. It is led by our superintendent, Drew Evans, who is also here today. But as you know, BCA provides investigative services, specialized law enforcement services. They assist in solving crimes with law enforcement. BCA also provides resources, of course, across the state of Minnesota, again, in partnership to help keep our communities safe. Some of their statewide coverage, of course, our headquarters is on Maryland Avenue in St. Paul. The superintendent reminded me to let all of you know as well that if anyone would like a tour, certainly to get a hold of us, to get a tour of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, it is quite impressive to see those operations and all that goes on within the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and how they support all of us. Our newest field office is in White Earth Tribal Police, and that office was set up just to really help address some of the fentanyl and opioid concerns that we have in this area. I'll move on to the investigative division. Again, very busy year for the Bureau. Opened nearly 2,500 cases in 2022. Some of the things that they certainly work on, predatory crimes section, agents that work to disrupt several things, including distribution and consumption of child sexual abuse material. They also, in 2019, they had 3,000 tips for this. It went up to 7,000 tips in 2022, so the workload is certainly increasing. They also work within the Human Trafficking Task Force and the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, handle violent crime, narcotics, the Force Investigation Unit, which has certainly been busy as well. They support especially use of force, deadly force investigations is probably the most high-profile thing that they do around the state of Minnesota. Their forensic science service area, they are the state's all-service laboratory. You can see a long list of things that we do for free for law enforcement agencies. There is a large increase in DNA and firearm laboratory work in 2021 and 2022, and the scale of work seems to be continuing to grow. There were more than 19,000 cases submitted to the BCA for testing. So again, it's a busy lab. The Minnesota Justice Information Services section, also very busy, but they maintain the state's criminal justice records through more than 30 systems. These are critical, of course, and again, help to continue to make us safe. Some of the achievements that I wanted to cover for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, they created the Minnesota Crime Data Explorer. This, again, is going to allow anyone to look into crime data as soon as we get it instead of waiting for those annual crime reports. So trying to use technology and data to better inform and be more transparent. We have fully implemented a sexual assault kit tracking system, try to bring some more accountability through that system, ensure that, you know, victim survivors also have the information that they need, and have really been working as well in violent and gun crime reduction across our metro area and across the state of Minnesota as we need to. That's our quick overview of the Department of Public Safety. I apologize if I spoke too fast, and I will sincerely apologize to Jordan for not saying his name correctly and for not bringing the dog.
Thank you, Commissioner. So, members, what we'll do now is we'll have time for questions. And actually, Commissioner, if you can just stay, we'll start with any questions for you since you're already at the table. So, and then we'll go back to the Private Detective Boards, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We're a little ahead of time, so at that point, hopefully, Director Wrights can finish his presentation, and then we'll move to questions about for the Department of Corrections. I'll also just remind you that the agencies will be coming back when their budget bills are before us, so you'll have additional opportunities at later hearings as well to ask questions. So let's open the floor for any questions we have right now. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I'm looking forward to meeting with you privately, actually. I've been doing a number of my time here as a legislator. I've been able to work with EMS, and I've noticed that there's also a hole that is mirrored by EMS with our volunteer fire guys and women throughout the state. I think that's going to be one of the pressing things in your term here is to what are we going to do about these lack of volunteers and large response times in the outstate, and I'm looking forward to hopefully sharing with you what I found and where we're hoping to what we're hoping to do in these areas as legislators. But I also look forward to your vast experience here to see if we can add to that. So,
go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative, thank you for bringing that topic up. We don't necessarily work directly with EMS, except those that are out of fire departments, but it certainly has become a topic of discussion across all of our public safety professions, and including EMS, and certainly, I think, in greater Minnesota, that's become certainly an issue for response times and ability to attract those who want to serve in those positions. One of the things we hope to do from the Department of Public Safety is not only increase, make sure that our staff feel like they're a value and that we're really doing some good work, but for those all across the state of Minnesota that are doing this work, and hopefully we can help raise the profile and raise the feeling amongst those who work, especially in those really difficult areas of our state of Minnesota and EMS, who don't always have the support and the funding perhaps that they need, but to really again raise the profile and to encourage and to get more people who want to volunteer or get paid low wages to be able to respond to those emergencies. This is all about a safe Minnesota, and the Department of Public Safety represents safety. That's part of our mission. That's what we're here to do and help to support. And so in any way that we can work with you, sir, we will certainly do that because we do know that's critical.
Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank Superintendent Evans and Jordan Halt-Ofterhide, whose name I can pronounce, for working with me on an annual reporting requirement for the Fusion Center. I think it's very important that we understand basically what data is collected, how much of it, who it's being shared with, and the quantifiable benefit of all of that data collection. I'm excited to be working across the aisle with the other body on this bill, and look forward to working with you on that this session. Thank you. Commissioner?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative, again, thank you for bringing that up. Jordan, and I'm not going to try to pronounce the name today. I'm going to practice when I get back home. We have staff that are always very willing to work. Fusion Center is critical to the success of what we do. Transparency and sharing information, especially with our legislative partners, I think is extremely important, and we look forward to working with all of you. Thank you.
Any other questions for the commissioner? All right, thank you again for being here today. We really appreciate it. And we will call the private detective board testifiers back up, please. And I believe that Vice Chair Feist has a question for Ms. Preza. Thank you. Go ahead. And I also just had one quick comment for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Just on Thursday, we'll be hearing a bill that I introduced on labor trafficking that's going to update the definitions around debt, bondage, and forced labor or services. Conferring quickly on our end, it looks like we don't need to do anything with that bill, but just wanted to notify you that we are tweaking those definitions as they would relate to sex trafficking as well. And question that I had is, you mentioned that you have an increased reliance on private security services, and I was just curious, obviously more money always helps, but is there anything that we can do in terms of targeted investments or policies to support your work in light of that increase?
Go ahead, Ms. Kreza.
Thank you. I think it is important to note that the total budget for our division is $277,000. 95% of which is salaries of the four people. So we have very little in that sense. I think there's a misconception, too, that the unlicensed people that are out working at this time is something that we can oversee, and statutorily we cannot, and we're also not law enforcement to enforce that. So I think there's a misconception there, so we need to come up with some solution, I think, there. With some statute changes, language changes. I would defer to Abby see if she could add to that since she's been with the division for a while.
Go ahead, please introduce yourself for the record and answer that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Abby Smith, and I have been with the Board of Private Detectives and Protective Agent Services for approximately 3 years now. I'm an investigative analyst for that division. I'm responsible for investigating any complaints and reviewing all new license applications. Kind of piggybacking on what Chris had mentioned, our budget is fairly limited to staff salaries, and I think the biggest challenge that we face is our limitations legally in what the public or other constituents are wanting us to be responsible for when it comes to unlicensed activity and investigation of these entities that do not operate with a license. We don't have a way to regulate their training or their background checks because of those legal limitations that are put on us per statute. If we were able to have any sworn employees that are able to have that law enforcement background and able to make those legal interactions with unlicensed entities or have more control and power over having those interactions, I think that would be a big way to ensure a more safe industry and maybe helping these unlicensed entities become licensed if it is a lack of education on that part.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Any follow-up?
No follow-up. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. And members, I forgot to mention that you do have in your packet a letter from someone in the public about the licensing board. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's actually a really nice transition for my question, which is to sort of follow up on that letter and just the basic point. I guess I hadn't quite realized this before, but so there's these requirements of having, requirement of having a license in order to act as a protective agent or private detective as defined under statute. But what is the consequence of not having that license? I gather from the letter that you all are not necessarily empowered to or maybe disagreement about how much you're empowered to do that, but is it a crime? Is it a misdemeanor? Like, sort of, if you can just talk about the consequences of not having a license to do this work.
Not sure who's going to answer, if it's Ms. Crazer or Ms. Fiff.
I can
go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative. So per statute, it is a gross misdemeanor to operate without a license. And with us not being or having any sworn staff, we can't charge. So it does fall to the local law enforcement jurisdiction to bring those charges and ultimately pursue action against them. We can report and defer it to that law enforcement agency, but we do not have the power to press charges.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and if you could just repeat again, the numbers of licensed versus unlicensed is what again in the state? Madam Chair, I missed that earlier.
Go ahead, Ms. Crazer.
Thank you. We have a total between the both private investigator and protective agent board of 384, with the Department of Economic Development showing about 510 that report to them.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I don't know why I thought I'd heard that second number being even bigger, but still it's a fairly big gap. Oh, so it looks like you may have something to add.
Correct. We have 13,000 that are employed by various licensed agencies.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so if they're employed by a licensed agency, then they are presumably in compliance. It's a license holder. So there's just some chunk. I guess it sounds like, though, there's at least like 100-some agents out there who are committing a gross misdemeanor right now by doing this work and not having a license. At least it seems likely that that's the case.
Any follow-up, Ms. Craig?
So just a little bit of my background. I worked for the state for 31 years. I was a trooper, and I was the manager of the 911 center. And when I got out of that, I got into private security as a dispatch analyst and then eventually went into a company that started as a license holder. And I can tell you that there are a lot of companies out there that are operating without a license, and those that are licensed, because it is such a there's such a dramatic uptick of needing to secure their buildings. The private security industry is in schools, they're in public buildings, they're outside of bars, they're on the streets, they're outside of your sporting venues, just making up for what law enforcement can't provide. So there are people that are armed that have had zero to no training, little to no training. It's out there and it's prevalent.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, so I guess maybe done with the questions. That's just really notable to me. And the fact, acts as gross misdemeanors. You have people in those situations being described who are committing a crime of that level. Certainly something for us to look into. So thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And real quickly here, I know we're short for time here. Along Representative Pinto's line here, but only different, I looked at the requirements here that you laid forward, and maybe I'm reading this wrong, but it seems like you have a large financial responsibility on licensing. Is this for an individual, or is this for a company, or what is that for?
Go ahead, Ms. Kreisak.
It would be for all of that. It would be for individuals, license, for companies, for LLCs. We license all of them.
So they would. I'm sorry, Madam Chair and the testifier. So this would be the requirement for X person coming in wanting a security license or a private investigator license, that they would have to go to a CPA, get a statement of net worth, an insurance policy, and then go to their bank and get an irrevocable line of credit. That's a big requirement for an individual, I would think. But, I mean, is there a reason that we have it like this? Is it us that made this requirement, or is it a recommendation? What was it?
Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. So if you are referring to the proof of financial responsibility, those are several options that they have. So it would be a net worth statement or an irrevocable letter of credit. They do not need all requirements. So most often we see them getting general liability insurance and not having the irrevocable letter of credit. We give them a couple different options to choose so they can take that responsibility on themselves on how they want to present that. As far as where that requirement came from, I cannot speak to that. We definitely can do some research and get back to you on where that requirement originated and where it does come into play.
And Ms. Smith, if you could provide that to Ms. McDaniel, too, then we can share that information with the entire committee. Any follow-up, Representative Hewitt?
Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I don't want the state standing in the way of somebody trying to do the right thing here and getting licensed, so I think it would be nice to have more information on what the procedure would be simply. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks. Any other questions for these testifiers? All right. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. And we'll call Director Wright back up to be able to finish his presentation. And also I'll just say, Director Wright, if you want to provide us with a sentencing grid so that we can provide those in the member packets, we can also post those online. There are three separate sentencing grids. For prosecutors and judges and defense attorneys, they're all electronically available now, but they are, before that was so readily available, they were laminated because they get so well used in court. And I'll just comment too on this when you were talking about departures, just so people are clear. You had mentioned that in order to depart from sentencing guidelines, whether that's an upward or aggravated departure or a downward or mitigated departure, there has to be substantial and compelling reasons for that. And if, let's say, a judge departs upward and doesn't articulate those substantial and compelling reasons or have good reason for that, those do get appealed and they do get reversed on appeal. And the same thing if a judge were going to depart downward without those substantial and compelling circumstances, those also get appealed and judges do and can get reversed on those. So following the sentencing guidelines is something that I think practitioners take very, very seriously. And let's see, do we have questions? I think Representative Grossel, you had a question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for coming back up, Director Wrights. I guess one thing that's been weighing on my mind and continues to is to what the Sentencing Guidelines Commission is doing with the custody status points.
Go ahead, Director.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in 2018, the Commission did look at the criminal history score in general and the different components of that criminal history score. We have felony points. As I said, the biggest factor, there's also misdemeanor points. Juvenile points, very limited. Misdemeanor points are pretty limited as well. And then there's this thing called custody status point, which is a little different because it's not looking at your criminal history exactly. It's looking at what was your legal status at the time you committed this offense. And were you under some kind of government supervision? What, custody sounds like jail or prison. That is a custody status. But the most common custody status is being on probation. And that's always that was very controversial when the commission looked at this in 2018. There were a number of different proposals. Some people said, let's just get rid of the custody status point. Ultimately, the biggest change to custody status points were that we're going to take lower level offender offenses. If you're on custody status for, say, a misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor, a targeted misdemeanor or a gross misdemeanor DWI or a non-traffic gross misdemeanor, or a lower level felony where you wouldn't even get a full point in criminal history, you shouldn't get a full custody status point. So the commission dropped that down to a half a point. I made a mistake in drafting that language so that it wasn't rounded correctly. And the commission's been working on fixing that mistake essentially for 3 years. So this Thursday meeting is going to be the commission's third go-round. Go-round number one in January of 2020 was basically a technical fix to fix the rounding issue. But for complicated reasons, that blew up. January 2021, there was going to be a broader fix, but the commission backed off of that at the last minute. So we'll see what happens on Thursday as far as what's going to happen with custody status. I don't know. I can't tell you. We'll find out on Thursday. So, and you'll find out on Friday when you get the report.
Thank you. Representative Russell.
One of the more disturbing things to me was that it was being kicked around to get rid of the 2 points for sexual assault.
Madam Chair, Representative Grassel, there was at one point a consideration to just eliminate custody status altogether. But other than that proposal, I think every proposal that I've seen has had the 2 points for repeat sex offenses. So this is somebody who's on probation for a sex offense, commits a new sex offense. You actually get double the custody status points rather than half. I hope I'm not misstating anything, but other than that one proposal to eliminate custody status altogether, which is not currently on the table, that every proposal maintains the 2 points for repeat sex offenses.
Representative Russell, anything else?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, if I can just respond to the Vice Chair's question regarding House File 42 and the first recommendation here.
Go ahead. Sure.
So I think it's House File 42. I would just say that my comment to that would be that House File 42 might be a really good vehicle for incorporating that first recommendation, especially since House File 42, as I understand it, and I hope I've got the number right, it actually redefines the term forced labor or service or forced labor or services to forced or coerced labor or services. So we're going to have two different terms, right? There's going to be sex trafficking is still going to say forced labor or services, which is nowhere defined. And then labor trafficking is going to say forced or coerced labor or services. So right now, maybe a judge could sort of guess that the legislature intended for the same definitions to apply to both statutes. But that guess will be a little more tenuous if the term is changed. So you might want to think about sort of marrying the two up, which is what the commission's recommending here, is marrying the two up. Now, the commission obviously doesn't have a recommendation specifically with respect to your bill, because that bill did not exist when the commission was making this recommendation.
Yeah. So I think we're going to, if you could, we'll go offline to discuss this.
Sure.
And just a reminder that amendments for the bills being heard on Thursday are due at noon tomorrow.
Okay.
So please stick around afterward, and maybe the two of you can connect that.
I'd be delighted.
Wonderful. I believe we also have a question from Representative Pinto.
Well, and actually, it's just a really brief comment that sort of connects to that. The sex trafficking and prostitution, your recommendations, I guess just a note for members, those statutes are really pretty messed up, and I'm trying to continue to work on them, and if members want to follow up on what this Guidelines Commission is recommending, I'd love to connect with you on that. Thanks for the indulgence, Madam Chair.
Great. So double stick around then.
All right.
And then Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. Executive Director Rice, think you do a great job. Any of the questions I'm going to ask in the next couple minutes, they're not directed at you. It's not a reflection of your work. It's a reflection of what gets done with the information that you gather. Okay. Could you describe how a person, if they wanted to study sentencing trends, say, for example, one judge in Hennepin County against another judge in Hennepin County, or how Hennepin County judges go against Kuching or Beltrami County in regards to sentencing deviations or disparities in the race or anything like that? How would a person do that if they wanted to do that?
Director Reitz.
Madam Chair, Representative Novotny, so we do publish data reports. You'll get sort of a mini version and actually an early peek at the 2021 data report in your report to the legislature, which I've got a sneak peek of that on the next slide. But and that does compare different judicial districts in terms of sentencing practices to some degree. So you can compare maybe not one county against another, but Hennepin and Ramsey being their own judicial districts, I guess you can compare them to other regions of the state. We don't typically publish data on, say, judge-by-judge basis because different judges honestly can have different caseloads. Their cases can be different. They, you know, they might have only sentenced one of these cases in a given year, and it's hard to compare apples to oranges. But we will. One of the things that we do as I'm just going to skip to this last slide here. So my staff publishes sentencing practices data reports, as I said, but we also prepare individual sentencing data reports upon request. So members of the public, we get a lot of requests from lawyers, but if you have a question about sentencing practices, and particularly like departures from the sentencing guidelines or that sort of thing, we will respond to those requests. So with the caution that it's a challenge to compare one judge to another because, as I said, different judges have different. I mean, the judge's job is to look at the individual case, and different individual cases are different. So,
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Director Reitz, so that leads to my question is, as a private citizen, if they wanted to investigate, for example, I've seen some private organizations that estimate over half of all presumptive sentencing to prisons for violent crime in this state right now are not being sentenced to that prison sentence, and the downward departures for sentencing are way off the scales. My question and formatting it is, sentencing guidelines gathers this information. You say in your presentation that departure should be made only when substantial and compelling circumstances exist. Right. What happens when they don't? Mm-hmm. Is there a reporting mechanism in sentencing guidelines if we do have a judge that is doing racially desperate sentencing? Is there any flags for that? Is there any remedies if you see that as a problem?
Director Reitz.
Madam Chair, Representative Novotny, yes. On a data side, we do collect departure information, and judges are required by law to give us departure information, including the reasons for departure. So we collect that. We do not judge it. We do not like say, "Oh, that's not good enough for a departure." But we do collect it, and we ask the judges if they can tell us, was this a prosecutor recommended disposition, or was this something? You know, did the prosecutor support or not? Not support this particular departure, for example, but we don't judge it. The Court of Appeals judges it if somebody appeals it. So if there's a mitigated departure, and mitigated meaning either it's a shorter sentence or it's a stay instead of a prison commit. If there's a mitigated departure, the prosecutor has the right to appeal that sentence to the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, and then they can reverse it if the Court of Appeals says, no, those were not substantial and compelling reasons justifying departure, which does happen sometimes. But we also see that a lot of these mitigated departures are with the support of the prosecutors. At least that's what judges are telling us on their departure reports. And I actually could... Maybe this would be a good time, Madam Chair, for me to talk about the next slide, where we do talk about some of those interesting data points that go to what Representative Novotny was just saying.
Representative Novotny, is that all right? Can we move to that slide, or did you have another?
Just one quick thing, and I even forgot what it was that I was going to touch on. I remember what I was. Tying into the presentation by BCA Commissioner Jacobson, the BCA has got the crime information network, Crime Explorer data that they are now publishing, a searchable database. You've got all the information in your files that all these judges fill out the worksheets and send to you. Is there any reason that you could see why that couldn't be put on a public website and searchable the same way the BCA is formatting their crime data?
Director Wright.
Madam Chair, Representative Notney, well, there's two issues. One is an issue of resources. We're a small agency, and we don't necessarily have the resources to do that. There was a bill last year that would have required us to do that, and we would have done that given the sufficient resources. The second is there has historically been a concern about what we were talking about before, comparing apples to oranges and sort of saying, well, this judge is soft on crime. Well, that judge's caseload is nothing like this judge's caseload if you compare the two. So, I mean, that is a challenge, but if the legislature were to require that and fund it, we would do it if we had a mandate to put a data dashboard on our website, for example.
Thank you, Chair Mueller.
Yep. All right. Great. And I know Representative Hudson has a question, and I do want to make sure that we have a chance to call Commissioner Schnell back up here because there's at least one member question for that commissioner. So go ahead, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This will be brief. My question is there any indication of what percentage of departures, because you say they come with an explanation as to why they departed downward, what percentage of those are citing the lack of corrections resources? So we simply don't have some place to put someone.
Directorate.
Madam Chair, Representative Hudson, I don't specifically have an answer for that. I know that the primary reason that's cited is amenable to probation or amenable to rehabilitation. That's typically what's cited, that this defendant doesn't need to go to prison because this defendant can be rehabilitated, essentially.
Yep. Do you want to share your slide? Is that
if you like, Madam Chair?
Yeah, so if you can just touch on those three points, and then Commissioner Schnell, if you can come on down while Director Wright is doing that, and we'll be all ready for you.
And the first point isn't sentencing guidelines data; it's Bureau of Justice Statistics data. But it does talk about Minnesota's, and it talks about Commissioner Schnell's job too. Minnesota has the sixth lowest imprisonment rate in the nation, which is interesting because throughout the history of the sentencing guidelines since 1980, it's always been in the usually one, two, or three lowest, sometimes four, lately five. But the last couple of years, it's crept up to six. So that's the first time we're seeing that. And that's not because its imprisonment rate is rising. It's because other states' imprisonment rates are falling faster than Minnesota's. But we do have the fifth highest probation rate. We did see a rebound, as you might expect, from the 2020 was a very low case volume, relatively speaking, and that did rebound in 2021. The sentencing guidelines recommended executed prison at a record high rate, 36.1%. Not exactly sure why that is. Among those prison recommended cases, and this goes to what Representative Notney was talking about, there was a record high mitigated dispositional departure rate, 45.7%. So among those 36% of cases that were recommended prison, we saw, which is a record high rate, we saw 45.7% not go to prison, which is also a record high rate among that percentage. So very interesting trends, and I'm not exactly sure why. The average pronounced prison length was also a record high, 54 months. So among those who actually did go to prison, they're going to prison for longer, and we continue to see differences by race and geography. We talked about what resources we offer. Just want to touch on fiscal notes. When you look at a fiscal note for a crime bill, you're going to see the cost in terms of prison beds if it's adding a new crime, and you'll see the out years, you know, for the tails. I just want you to know, these kind of bills take a long time for the cost to develop. So you might see like a bill with hundreds of prison beds cost, but it doesn't have very much cost right now because it's a slow burn. It's going to take years. So I encourage you to flip open the fiscal note, not just look at the first page, to see the real eventual cost of a prison bed impact. And we do estimate the racial and demographic impact of select crime bills. We send those to the chair, vice chair, and minority lead. We can also return to brief you on details of felony sentencing practices and trends. We just lightly touched on that. The proposed changes to the guidelines, we'll see what that is on Friday. Details of these legislative recommendations are sex trafficking review. And we do have some possible budget change requests. We'll see what the governor does with those. The idea there to advance sentencing policy and data to really give you a better evidence base for your decisions. Thank you, Madam Chair, for giving me those extra few minutes.
Yeah, thank you so much, and I'm sure we'll be seeing you again before the committee. Welcome back, Commissioner Schnell, and Representative Becker-Finn has a question for you.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Just wanted to lift up, you know, I know we're going through these slides pretty quickly, but wanted to lift up the statistic on one of the DOC slides about 1 in 6 kids in Minnesota has a parent who's has been or is incarcerated. And so I just wanted to lift that up because I know, you know, the generational impact of that is huge. It, you know, it, yes, it's a here and now problem as we look at capacity and, you know, the actual, like, people getting back into the community and having jobs, but there's also a long-term impact. You know, that's an adverse childhood experience. As I sit next to the children and families chair, you know, that is going to impact kids and families and people for generations, even when those children grow up to be adults. And so, you know, we've done work with the Healthy Start Act. You know, that's just a very small number of cases, but just wondering if you can give us, if you have it, a quick update on the Healthy Start Act and other things that we may be able to do in that realm to impact that generational trauma that's created by that.
Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, Chair Becker Finn, yes, we, you know, Healthy Start is fully active. We have a number of women who are actively involved in the program, and it has been truly, I think, a real benefit of keeping the women and their infants together, and I think that has been incredible. There remains work to be done around programming specific to, you know, trauma-based services in the facilities. One of the things that we noted was we created a new assessment summary tool for people coming into the system. For this is done by all people who enter the prison system, and we found we for the first time asked them about their own ACEs. And we saw just incredible adverse childhood levels of adverse childhood experiences for the people that are incarcerated. One of those being having a parent who was incarcerated. And so one of the things that we are really working with the Department of Education on and are incredibly excited about is we look at trying to lift up education programs in the correction system, because we know that that works, it pays dividends, it reduces recidivism. Ultimately, we also want to see what the net impact is, and the research tells us that children of the incarcerated who are involved in education programs, their educational outcomes will improve as well. And so that the dividends that can be paid by these types of investments have a lot of benefit, not just in the here and now, but going forward.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's see, I think we have Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Commissioner, in my previous time in the legislature, served on the Corrections Committee, and then we talked a lot about employment and staffing levels for our, specifically our prisons and where we're at there. How has that changed over the last couple of years, and where are we at today on being able to staff up and making sure that we have enough people in the prisons?
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Tapke, I think this has been an incredible challenge. As I said earlier, for public safety across the board, law enforcement agencies are struggling as well. We've hired the highest number of employees, new hires, in the history of this agency. We are struggling on retention. And one of the big challenges is that, you know, we are looking at issues around competitiveness and wage, number one. Number two, high rates of forced overtime because we don't have adequate workforce. And so we're having to force people to work overtime on a regular basis. As we sit today, we are at, we have 91% of our authorized strength is filled. So we have a 9% vacancy rate agency-wide. That is a major concern. We budget with about a 3% vacancy rate, just because we know that there's an agency this large is always going to be turnover, and so you're always going to have that. But that 6% gap is substantial, and it's a major concern, and one of the things that we are extensively focused on, have done a lot to bring new people in the door, use some of the recovery funds that we were able to secure to pay some incentives. But you know, this is not just a money issue. It is a much broader issue as we look at the public safety sector across the board.
Thank you.
All right, great, thanks. And members who are looking at the clock in the room and members of the public, that clock is a little bit fast. So we are looking at our phones to keep track of time, and we have 1 minute left. So thank you so much for being here, Commissioner, and to all our testifiers today. Members, we have three bills on the agenda for Thursday. We have Representative Richardson's bill to create an office for missing and murdered black women and girls. We have Vice Chair Feist's bill amending the definition of labor trafficking. We heard a little bit about that today. And then we have my bill addressing the crime of surreptitious intrusion. And all of the information will be posted on the committee's webpage. And with that, members, this meeting is adjourned.